like so.
Yeah.
And you'll get exactly the same answer. Okay, so what will happen is that here, remember, if I take and rewrite this, then I can rewrite this piece as cosine of omega t over 2 t plus times the identity plus I sine omega t over 2 t sigma z, right? And then sandwich it in there and go through the algebra, and you'll see that what you end up with is one term out of this that's going to be at DC, and there'll be another term that's at twice the angle. So did I answer your question? But everything will work out the same. You'll still get a DC term out of this. And so it's the DC term that we want. Okay? So remember that there's two pieces to the rotating wave approximation. One that says go into the interaction frame. And there's no approximation there. That just says that we're looking at it in a different reference frame. And then the approximation is to drop the term that goes, the time-dependent term, right? I'm not sure I answered your question. Okay, then I have to look at your exact math, because here, if I go through this, I'm going to end up with a term that's DC already, and so. But let's have a look.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to spend just a couple minutes on the Nyquist theorem and sampling. And just because it comes up over and over again, and it's something that you should know. It has nothing to do specifically with the topic of the class, except it's a common tool. Okay, so let's say that we have a signal that's a function of time, and I want to characterize it. And an easy way of characterizing it, of course, is to take the Fourier transform and look at the frequency spectrum of that signal. So I could say that I wanted to look at S of omega being the Fourier transform of that. And in engineering, they would describe the Fourier transform in terms of that double angle, double arrow. Jeez. And we can write down the Fourier transform explicitly like so. And it might worry you that there isn't a factor of square root of 2 pi, or there isn't a negative sign, but there's so many conventions, and this is just as good as any other one. Okay, so now we've defined the Fourier transform, but of course we've explicitly said that S of t is a continuous function and that it's defined over all time. And of course the only requirement that we need for the Fourier transform to exist is that S of t is square integral. So all sorts of nice things, yeah? But we don't do that, in fact. What we do always is that we end up sampling S of t. So we're only going to have S of t at a finite number of data points. And if we sample, the easiest way to sample is to sample periodically. So if we periodically sample, then I can say that I have S of n, which is equal to S of n tau, where tau is the sampling time, so this is a constant, And we'll define the sampling time in terms of a frequency. And this frequency will be the Nyquist frequency. Okay, now the thing to look at quickly, now of course, you know, the Fourier transform is just based on the on sinusoids being a complete set of functions. So let's just look at a sinusoid. Since it's complete, if we look at one, we know everything about it. Yeah? So I'm going to take S of t to be cosine of omega t. And now what I'm going to do is to allow omega to be greater than omega n and less than twice omega n. Okay, you'll see how this all works out, but let's just look at the case where omega is greater than omega n, and therefore I can rewrite omega as being omega n plus delta omega, right? And delta omega now is a positive number. Yeah?
We are integrating in that, we are doing a Fourier integral over there, but over here, cosine is periodic, so.
Yeah. But I'm multiplying it by that, right?
Okay.
Okay, did I assume incorrectly that you guys all know Fourier transforms? So you're saying, yes, I assume correctly that you all know Fourier transforms. Good. I'm happy. Okay. So now then, it's trivial. We rewrite S of n. So S of small n is equal to cosine of omega n plus delta omega times n pi over omega n. These are capital N's. Yeah? Really nice. And so, oh, well, then it's equal to cosine of n pi plus delta omega over omega n of n pi. Yeah? So this is equal to cosine of minus delta omega n pi over omega n. And so what does it tell us? It says that if I have a frequency which is greater than the Nyquist condition, then it's going to appear, when you take the Fourier transform, to have a lower value, a lower frequency. And if we plot it, if I plot here the observed frequency versus the actual frequency, then we would see that up until the Nyquist frequency, it's exactly the same. And then afterwards, it goes down. And then, of course, it goes up. And we have this triangular wave going on for all time. Okay? And so if I have a frequency over here, it appears to be aliased. It appears that it's showing up at the wrong frequency. And so really, it's a really simple idea. And that's the wrong figure. Here. Oh, you can't see it anyways. Oh, I don't even plug it in. And remember that we've defined, I should have said that explicitly, over here we've defined the Fourier transform as its integral. If we sample a discrete number of points, we replace this with the obvious discrete representation of the Fourier transform. Nothing surprising there. So here, all I've done is to wake up. Is to show you explicitly that if I have a series of cosines that are separated, that are offset from each other by the Nyquist frequency, and if I'm sampling at these particular points, that's of course, they all coincide at those particular points. And that's all the sampling theorem is saying. The sampling theorem says that if you want to sample a cosine, you must sample faster than twice a period. All right. So the y-axis is the actual frequency, and the vertical axis is the observed frequency once you've taken the Fourier transform, once you've taken a discrete Fourier transform. Yeah? All right. So enough of that. Good. Now then, the next thing I wanted to talk about is the Hongo-Mandel effect. So we had our NV diamond system, and remember that what we did, we had a laser at 532 nanometers. That's a source. And we sent it into a device that we could chop it, which is an acoustic optical modulator. And then we sent it to a dichromatic laser, a dichromatic mirror. Dichromatic laser might be a more interesting device. We send it to a microscope. We have a piezo stage to do imaging with the confocal microscope. And off here, I'm not going to draw it in yet, we had a single photon detector. And so what happens is that the 532 nanometers goes that way, and the 637 nanometers goes the other direction. And the 637 can go around the corner, and the 532 goes that way. Good. Now, we looked at an image of one of these diamond samples. When we looked at an image of the diamond sample, we saw individual bright spots. And what we'd like to do is we'd like to say that in one of those bright spots, there is, in fact, only one defect. Okay. And the spot size that we're looking at is really quite small. It's some microns. But still, you know, that's if you count the number of atoms, that's a lot of atoms. So what Hong O and Mandel looked at was the statistics of what happens if I have a beam splitter. So we looked at this already. Here we have a beam splitter. Now it's an optical beam splitter. And so I have two inputs. I have two outputs. And I'm going to describe the physics more compactly than Mandel would. And if you haven't seen it, Mandel's written a really nice short book on coherent optics recently. He's a grand old man of optics. And when you want to know everything about optics, you go back to Wolff's book, which Mandel rewrote. Okay. But he wrote a short book, which contains a lot of fun things. Okay, so here we have a beam splitter, and the unitary for the beam splitter is just the Hadamard transformation. So there's very nice. And we make a promise as we describe this. We're going to make a promise that there's only one photon in at most in each of the input legs. Okay? So there's either going to be zero or one photon in each of those legs. Now you know what's going to happen is if I have an input state where I have one photon in one of the legs. Don't need to keep drawing that out. We'll get a coherent superposition of the photon leaving in both legs. And if I had the photon coming in the other leg, I would still get a coherent superposition of the photon it coming out in both of those, but of course it would have this sign change, this phase shift. Now it's optics, and so since it's optics, we're going to look at this in terms of creation and annihilation operators. So I can say, oh well, if I have this case here, case one, then what happens? And we still have the O and the H beam just as we did in neutrons. What happens is I have A dagger in O plus A dagger in H. And it's not so nice, but the proper normalization is 1/2, but we can forget that and put a square root of 2 there as you like. But this is the output state that we would have. And you've all seen these creation annihilation operators before. Life is good. And of course, what would happen here is exactly the same thing, except that we would have, again, the sign change. And now if I have both photons coming in, so you know, zero photons coming into each is boring, but I could have one photon coming into each of these. And if I have one photon coming into each, then we end up with the nice result that the photons leave either by one side or the other. That if I have two photons coming into a beam splitter, they can only leave by both going in one direction or both going in the other direction. There is no interference term. So the photons both take O or H. And the way we do the experiment, and let me draw it over here. Because this experiment, yeah.
How do you see that result? Do you just consider a classical mixed state input density matrix and then apply U on that and see what's the output?
Well, we're not assuming, yes. Essentially, we're saying that we have two independent actions that occur at the same time. Yep. So let's look at this. We have our beam splitter, we have two sources here, we have two outputs, the outputs go to detectors, the detector goes to a delay line, and then the two of them go to a coincidence counter. So the coincidence counter simply says it's going to give a click if these two events came at the same time. Okay. And then we look at the probability of the coincidences, and what we see is this dip as a function of the delay. So when we've set the delay just right, that the two photons arrive at exactly the same time, then we see that the coincidences go to zero, because the photons either went here or there. There was no coincidence. There was no case where the photons went to each. As we shift the time, you know, if I have photons that are coming in at different times, then of course the two events look random, and we see that there can be coincidences. Yeah? Does that make sense to you? So this width here is the same width we saw in the neutron interferometry case. That width is the coherence length. So I have a photon coming in, and it has some wave packet. And I have a photon coming in here, and it has a wave packet. And in order for the beam splitter to treat those as two identical photons, the wave packets have to overlap in time. And if they overlap in time, then they will either go this way or this way, and will be down here. As we shift them relative to each other, they'll move. And you say, well, why do I put the delay here? Why don't I put the delay over here? Because all I'm saying at this point is I have two sources of photons. They're identical photons, but they're coming individually. Okay. And so the probability that two of them arrive at the same moment, this is just a random event. Okay. They weren't prepared in any way except to say that they have the same energies. Okay. And therefore, they can come through like that. Yeah? All right. So here, we do something that's almost the same. I put the beam splitter here, and we put two APDs. So single photon detectors. And again, we go to coincidence with a delay in a coincidence counter. Now what we're saying is that we have a single NV center here. So I have a single source. The single source is going to give out one photon at the time. So then as I scan this delay, what I should see is absolutely flat as I scan the delay. Because there's no chance that I have two photons in coincidence, right? Because we're getting out one photon at a time. I have a single photon source here. If, on the other hand, I saw that there was a dip, well, then I would know that I had another center there. Yeah? So again, we can use the Hondo-Mandel effect to prove that, in fact, in this case, we have just one source for the whole thing. Okay. Good. Now, in our setup that we've been talking about, the delay in the coincidence counter. Just like here, we have a delay in a coincidence counter. Okay. So this is the experiment as we normally use it, since we're only interested in having single single events there. Once we've shown that the statistics are that we have a single source, there's no point in going ahead and measuring the coincidence, because there won't be any. There's nothing. There won't be any dip. There's no interesting physics there. Okay, so let's remember. We've got the electron sitting in the diamond. It's a spin 1 electron. And so the Hamiltonian starts off with the zero field splitting. I'll use S for electrons. And then I'm going to add a magnetic field. And the magnetic field will have Zeeman frequency, and it's will depend upon the orientation of the field relative to the principal axis system of the zero field splitting. The principal axis system of zero field splitting is the bond that goes from the nitrogen to the vacancy. Then up here we have the same manifold, and they're labeled this way, not that it matters. And there's an intersystem crossing over here. And remember, the rules are that with probability 1/3, the up, up, and down, down states that compose the spin 1 and spin minus 1 states can go over to the intersystem crossing. And the intersystem crossing state, this asymmetric state, can only decay down to the MSZ0 state. And it does this with a time of 300 nanoseconds. It does give a photon off, but the photon actually doesn't make it to the APD. It has the wrong wavelength to get in there. So we don't see that photon, even if it is there. The zero state, if we excite this zero state, it falls back down to zero with a time scale of 30 nanoseconds. Yeah?
So if I understand correctly, the SZ squared is basically the two electrons which make up the effective spin 1 state. So SZ.
Yes, that's right.
Whereas the second I'm not sure which Hilbert space they're acting on, the second term.
Okay, hold on. Thanks. So we have two electron spins that, because there was a strong exchange interaction, fell into this SZ squared interaction, right? And don't think about that as SZ on one electron times SZ on the other electron, right? Because now what we've said is that there's an exchange interaction which is so strong that we can't distinguish between the electrons. So don't try to do that. So this really just says that the interaction looks like SZ squared, and so the piece of the Hamiltonian looks like that. That's right. Yeah. Oh, geez, I'm sorry. I should say that. Right. We often beat into that the squares of the polys are the identity. But that is a unique feature of being in SU2, right? That is, you go into a larger space, the squares of the effective spin operators are not the identity.
Yeah, I seem to have written down sigma in last lecture.
Yeah. No, I'm sure I use sigma. I generally do for higher spins. Thanks.
Why do we use we have a
So, if I understand right, here what we're saying is that we have only one NV center. So there isn't an ensemble of NV centers. It's just exactly one. And so that the dynamics are that of a microscopic quantum system. People have done experiments on looking at many NV centers together, but the dynamics are complicated because the principal axis system, because of the nitrogen vacancy bond, can take six different orientations in a single crystal of diamond, and so you get that heterogeneity or incoherence, as we've been calling it, in the dynamics. Is that your question? Okay. Yeah, so it's just one center here. Nothing, no more than that. Okay. Now then we're going to add to this some interactions. And the first interaction we add is the hyperfine interaction. The hyperfine interaction is a magnetic-magnetic interaction between the nuclear spin and electron spin. So we're going to add to this a C13. So here, plus we're going to add a single C13, and a C13 has spin 1/2. So the first piece that happens is that we have the Fermi contact interaction which has an interaction that looks like S dot I. Now, it is it's still a tensor, and it's a little bit nicer if I write it like this. So that A is a tensor spanned by those two spaces. It's a little bit nicer if I write it like this because, of course, I is a spin 1/2 operator, and S is a spin 1 operator, right? And so they live in different size spaces. But it's still just the isotropic piece of this, okay? So that's the Fermi contact piece. And then there's another piece, which is a dipolar interaction between the electron and the spin degree of freedom. And the dipolar interaction has axial symmetry, so it's not isotropic. Now, here, let's take a brief excursion and look at the sort of control that we're going to get there. Yeah. So the S dot I is here, the Fermi contact, and then the dipolar piece. So if I have two spin 1/2 systems coupled, one spin 1/2 coupled to another spin 1/2, the normal type of hyperfine interaction, then the Fermi contact piece is equal to just a frequency times sigma electron dot sigma nucleus. And the dipolar piece is equal to this, where the z-axis is the energy axis of the system. All right, so that for the electron spin, that has to be the zero field splitting. For the nuclear spin, it is often the Zeeman interaction, but it doesn't have to be that. Okay, but this piece, you know, there's an angle This is not isotropic. Okay, and of course this is not isotropic, right? But this is isotropic. Okay. So now let's take a piece of that. I'm going to now take these two terms. I'm just going to compact them. I'm going to take a complete description that is as compact as possible. Do you still have a question? Nope. Quick. Okay. So we'll have a Hamiltonian, one electron, one nuclear spin. The Hamiltonian is going to be all of the physics can be seen with just this piece. So here we've said that the electron spin is quantized along the z direction. Okay, so this I'm going to take to be the dominant interaction. So I'm taking the spin one half version of that, but keeping an interaction like the zero field splitting. So there's one piece that says, yeah, this is dominant. That's going to define the energy. So alternatively, what that means is that omega E is the largest frequency in this, right? It's the same thing. And then I'm going to look at the case where these three frequencies that depend upon the nuclear spin, okay, are about the same. Okay, so that's the way I want to look at this. Now, notice what happens. That we've only kept the terms for the electron spin that are sigma z. And the reason for that is exactly the rotating wave approximation. That we've said, here's a dominant interaction, that's the interaction frame we want to go into. And if we had terms that looked like sigma x or sigma y on the electron spin, we would have to drop them. Okay? Now, for the nuclear spin, since all of these terms have the same strength, I can't use the same approximation for the nuclear spins. I don't have any right to drop the x term of the nuclear spin because this frequency is about as strong as those frequencies. You will say, well, why didn't I include the y term? I don't need to include a y term, right? Because since I have x and z, then I'll generate a y contribution just in those commutators, right? And so I just want to have it as compact a representation as possible. Okay? Now, let's look at what happens here. We start off two energy levels split, defined by the electron spin, and split by omega E. The next piece I'm going to add is this. And this isotropic, this is called an isotropic term. Forget that. This term, the A term of the hyperfine interaction. And so the A term of the hyperfine interaction says that I get the splitting of these terms. Okay. And that splitting of terms comes from the dependence on the z state. And so at this point, I could write down a state for the system that would include both the electron and the nuclear spin, right? The nuclear spin, we've said, has a particular state. And so this would be up, 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 down, down, up, and down, down. And now I've made a mistake. So why don't I do this correctly, just for the fun of it? Of course, what you see is that the states that are both up or both down have positive energies. So this is the up-up state. and that's the down-down state, and this would be the down-up state, and this would be the up-down state, right? That's the correct ordering of those energy levels, right? Because we're going to choose this to have ms of plus and minus 1/2 or plus and minus 1/2, and so the products are going to be either plus 1/4 or minus 1/4. Yeah? And so we get this ordering of the energy levels. Okay, everything's still good. We can still have these pieces. So that comes here. Then I look at the nuclear Zeeman effect. So the nuclear Zeeman effect says shift the energy. Again, everything's secular so far. Right? We can write in, if you like, an identity for the electron spin. Everything's secular so far. And it says shift it depending upon the nuclear spin state. So then it says, okay, this state gets shifted down, this one gets shifted up, and this difference is the nuclear levels. This one gets shifted up, and this one gets shifted down. And again, the difference is the nuclear levels, the nuclear energy. So that's omega n. Okay? So now we still have four energy levels. And at this point, the selection rules are just as they were before. The selection rules say that we're allowed to have a single spin flip. So I can have a transition here, okay, which is a nuclear transition, right? The second spin. I can have a transition here, which is a nuclear spin. Or I can have a transition here, which is an electron spin flip, or here, which is an electron spin flip. Yeah, those are a lot of transitions. Okay? All right. Now then, I add this term. And here, of course, what it says is that this term respects the energy of the electron spin, but it's going to mix the nuclear spin states. Okay? And so what's going to happen is we're going to get a mixing of these states, and we'll end up with two states here and two states here. And now the electron spin still knows its state, right? The electron spin, in this case, is still up. But the nuclear spin is a mixture of up and down, right? So the nuclear spin I have to write as having a state, we'll just call it alpha. And here we have a state, which is the perp of alpha. That's it. I broke it. Okay, it's fixed. And here, again, the electron spin state we know, and we'll just call it beta. And the important thing to know is that the inner product of alpha and beta is somewhere between 0 and 1, right? It's not 0, it's not 1. The requantization of these things is, in fact, different than the two manifolds. Okay? Now you can see that up here as well. And let me look at this more clearly. Let's look at the nuclear spin in the case. We've said that the electron spin is well defined. So let's look at the nuclear spin in the case where the electron spin is up. Okay? Well, this term doesn't add any energy to the nuclear spin. Here we have a Zeeman energy. I called it N. Let's call it N there. And that, of course, is going to be the same whether the electron spins up or down. That's always there. Then I have the ZZ component to the hyperfine interaction, and that depends upon the electron spin. So the electron spin is up here, so we have another piece of an interaction along Z, which is the ZZ component of the hyperfine. And then I have a piece that's along the x-axis there, which has this speed dependence, right? And so that we're saying this is the effective field that the nuclear spins see if the electron's pointing up. Okay, so that's the quantization axis. And if you wanted to go through, if you did go through the rotating wave approximation in perturbation theory, this is the field you would find. Of course, if we take the spin down, well, the nuclear Zeeman piece is exactly the same. But the A term now has opposite sign, and the B term has an opposite sign. And so we end up having some effective field over here. Okay? And so when I go from one to the other, I need to realize that I'm changing the quantization axis. Okay. So now there's a couple of things to conclude from that. One is that I have universal control of the nuclear spin just by modulating the electron spin. Okay? So what does universal control mean? Universal control means that I can take the nuclear spin and I can rotate to any possible state. I can rotate it anywhere on the Bloch sphere. And that's not so surprising, right? Because it says, look, if the electron spin is up, we're rotating about this axis on the Bloch sphere. If the electron spins down, we're rotating about this other axis. And they're not trivially related to each other. And if I can rotate about two different axes, then I can rotate anywhere on a sphere. Okay? Now, if you want to yell at me and say, hey, you're a theorist, and you want to do this in a fancier way, well, that's easy. What's the generator of a spin flip for the electron, right? We said that we had to flip the electron. So the generator of a spin flip for electron is sigma x. Yep. And so if I say, okay, I'm going to take and add a Hamiltonian, our control Hamiltonian, which is equal to sigma x of the electron. And then I took these as generators. And I said, look at the algebra, look at the Lie algebra that you create by taking all the possible commutators with these. Then you would see that you would span all of SU4. Okay? And so it's easy, right? Just keep adding, keep going through commutators, 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 until you're not generating any more polys. And at that point, stop. Count up what you have, and if you have enough to span SU4, then you have complete control. Yep. So that's easy. The other thing that happens is in this system, and in any system with electrons, the electron has a shorter T1 than the nuclear spin. So the electron, by a short T1, what does that say? It says that the electron can flip. Right? And so if the electron can flip, what does that do to the nuclear spin? You know enough to write this out now. If I say there's a relaxation process, then that says that there's a random event, right? Relaxation is random. The electron's interacting with some environment, and it will on occasionally flip. When it flips, what does it do? It applies the similarity transform that takes you from here to there to the nuclear spin. Right? And so if it applies that similarity transform, you could write that out as a Krauss map. And what is the relaxation you see for let me make a real simple case. Let's say that we turned off this term. I can do that easily. I just say, okay, experimentally, I can set that up. Theoretically, you have an easier, even easier time. You just say, okay, I ignore it. So let's say I had two cases where with the electron spin up, I had one frequency, omega up, for the nuclear spin. With the electron down, I had another frequency, omega down, for a nuclear spin. But I'm going to put them both along the z-axis. Okay? And now I'm looking at the Krauss map for the nuclear spins that's going to describe the effect of the electron spin flipping. Yeah? There's some probability flips. We describe that. What's going to be the dynamic now? Well, what's going to happen? It says that, look, if I have the spin up, let's say that we start off with the spin up, just for the fun of it, then we would say that that we would have that would be our operator. And we would have zero map, and it would say that with 1 minus p to square root, we would get that. And well, you say, what is p? P is t over the electron t1. Maybe a factor of 2 there. Right? It says that if it flips, well, then you're going to get a different frequency about the z-axis. If it doesn't flip, you're going to get this one. And then you're going to say, well, this looks really clunky, right? Why am I keeping these two frequencies here? And why do I care if it starts in one or the other, right? Because it's a random event. And so you're going to take this, and you're going to rewrite it as k0 is equal to 1 minus p square root. The identity in K1 is equal to P 1 half E to the I delta omega T sigma Z. And then you're going to say, just leave it like that. And you're going to calculate an effective T2 out of this, right? And the change in frequency is going to tell you how strong the T2 is, plus the electron T1, right? So how dephasing this interaction is depends both on the difference in frequencies, right? If there's no difference in frequencies, then the electron spin can flip all day. Makes no difference, right? So it says, what's the difference in frequency, and what's the time scale? What's the probability that the electron flips? You had a question, Tibra.
Yeah, why the Krauss map is essentially a rotation around two different rotations around the z-axis, right?
Yeah.
And why those are the correct things to do to change the population.
Well, I'm not changing a population, right? In fact, it's a dephasing interaction, right. So it's not going to change any populations here. All I'm saying is, what is the effective map as we flip an electron spin? Yeah? And then I erased the other one that was here. But look, if these two are not lined up in the same axis, then the map isn't going to be just a dephasing map. It's going to be a depolarizing map as well. Yeah? Okay. So we have universal control over the nuclear spins without ever actually rotating the nuclear spins. We just rotate the electron spins, and we keep this term of course. And then we can do anything we like with the nuclear spins, indirectly by controlling the electron spins. Yes? It's not quite, no. There is a piece of it in there. But this is, it's related. It's related.
Did you have something that, like, you get control with your
spin? Yeah. Yeah.
But there's more than that.
Yeah. In the what I was talking about at PI, I have a string of electron spins. And here we have just one effective electron spin.
And that was not an NV center.
No, it wasn't.
Solid state.
Yeah. Okay. Now I want to show you one example of an experiment, and then we'll do some more next week. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So now let's talk here about just one electron spin, one nuclear spin, and look at this experiment. What I'm going to try to do is to write down a quantum non-demolition measurement. So we saw that we can take the electron spin not so important. We can take the electron spin, to the zero state just by pumping. Remember that as we turn the laser on, we end up in the zero state eventually, regardless of where we start. And then I'm going to make a swap gate that will put the nuclear spin in the zero state. So I'm going to do a controlled knot, or just a swap gate between the electron and the nuclear spin. So now then I end up with the state 0, 0. And then let's apply some arbitrary rotation to the electron spin. So we end up in the state 0, 0. Then we'll apply a controlled knot to the nuclear spin. We're going to rotate the nuclear spin. So we have this nice state. Now, from this nice state, I'm going to make a measurement. And when I make a measurement, I know that what I'm going to get out from that measurement is the electron spin going into the zero state. So I end up with the state that looks like this. Of course, I also get out some photons, okay? They tell me the probability that the electron was in either the zero or the one state. Okay, so we get out that. But there's still information here. And so now what I do is I apply a controlled knot to the electron spin. We're going to rotate the electron spin. And so we end up in the state like so, which is exactly the same state that we started out with. And now I'm going to go up here and measure some more. And I can keep repeating this for a time, which is the relaxation time of the nuclear spin. Not the electron spin, but the nuclear spin. Though I'm measuring, of course, the state of the electron spin. It's the wrong time. Here. So now here, what we've shown is the contrast. So on this axis is the intensity of the photons we get out. On this axis is simply the angle by which I've rotated the electron. Remember that I said that we're going to prepare an arbitrary state, which was alpha 0 plus beta 1. And here I'm saying that alpha is equal to cosine of an angle and beta is equal to sine of the angle. And the horizontal axis is that angle. Okay? And then the number is just the number of repetitions that we've done. And this is the integrated intensity over all the repetitions. And so you can see that as we increase the number, we keep doing this, we in fact do increase our probability of measuring the correct state. And you can see that the nuclear lifetime is very long, right? Because we can do 60 cycles of this. And of course, our control is not so bad. As we go further, you can see all the errors, but I won't show you all the errors. It's enough to show you this. So we have control. We can operate over the electron spin and the nuclear spin. We have universal control over both of those, very different than we had in the neutron interferometer. And we can see a single quantum system. Okay, so then next week, on Monday, I'm going to go through two more experiments with this. One is to show you how you can combine error correction with the quantum Zeno effect to preserve an arbitrary state. All of you guys know quantum Zeno effect, right? So it might be. In other words, we might do it. Do people know quantum Zeno? No? Okay. Well, we'll spend 2 minutes on quantum Zeno, and then we'll show you. So the quantum Zeno effect is a way of preserving a particular state. When we combine it with quantum error detection, we can preserve an arbitrary state. And then we're going to talk about what happens as we try to remove the noise from the nuclear spins from the electron spins in this system. And that, again, has a complexity because the nuclear spin sees a different eigenstructure depending upon the state of the electron spin. Okay? So we'll do those two, and then we'll be about done. Oh, I'll talk to you. Maybe I'll spend 2 days on NB centers. Do that on Monday. And then on Tuesday, describe for you how NB centers might be used as quantum repeaters. There was this idea that if you're doing quantum key distribution, we have photon losses. We send photons down fibers. And we would like to have a repeater so that we could improve the probability of communicating over long distances. And it was initially thought, in 1998, quantum repeaters were assumed to be just around the corner. It would be trivial to make. We still don't have one. The NB Center isn't a really great candidate for it. But it shows the physics, and it'll allow you to see what's difficult about that process that people should have recognized earlier. Okay. Great. You might try going through concretely and showing these maps. And if you do that, don't start by trying to write down the Krauss operators. Start by trying to write down the map and create the super operator. And then use the Choi decomposition to generate the Krauss operators. Because if you do it that way, then that extraction of the Krauss operators will correctly combine this phase and that probability.